Pickaxe.
Hey y'all, I'm Dr. Alok Kanoja, but the internet knows me as Dr. K. I spent 7 years studying to become a monk and then became a psychiatrist. I want to tell you a little bit about my podcast, Healthy Gamer GG, where we combine my clinical experience of practicing psychiatry and sprinkle in years of experience as a meditation teacher and sort of focus on spirituality. So on the podcast, we're going to approach very common everyday problems from each of these lenses. And what we really do well is blend science and spirituality to create the most accessible solutions for people for their everyday problems. So check us out at Healthy Gamer GG on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple.
And welcome back to The Review of Death, your fortnightly home for Doctor Who news and reviews. I should probably say that this is a Doctor Who podcast at the start, but I've said it now. You just did,
it's fine.
I did, so yeah, this is a Doctor Who podcast. If you don't like Doctor Who, why are you listening to this?
Bit of a two-parter.
Yes.
This one, so for the main bulk of the episode, you're going to be seeing a really, really cool chat that we had with Matthew Jacobs, who was the writer and co-producer of the 1996 TV movie, and also co-director with Vanessa Yule, who we were also speaking to, for Doctor Who Am I, which is a really fantastic, genuinely brilliant...
It was very good documentary.
...documentary about American fan culture and a bit about Matthew and his relationship with Doctor Who fandom and a bit about his own past and stuff. It's really, really good, really affectionate, really well put together. Highly recommend people check it out and see if they can find it. I think it's in cinemas on the 27th of October. I say the date in...
You say it in the interview.
Later in the episode. So it
comes up. Yeah. I was really annoyed. I watched it back. I should have said, his documentary would have been amazing for when I did fandom studies at university.
Oh, yeah.
It would have been... Literally perfect. Because they spoke to all the loonies that do all those things.
All the different case studies,
case studies. You know, like the cosplay and that girl who was on about regeneration fairies and all that stuff.
Yeah, that stuff is really interesting because that's a level of fandom you don't see here. You know, it's that kind of reinterpretation of things. It's not canon. What are you doing? Get that off.
Yeah.
Sorry, I sound a bit fucked up, but you know what I mean.
I think that's what Jonathan said when he watched it. Anyway,
miserable bastard.
Yes, so that's still to come. But first, we've got to talk about a certain trailer for a certain Doctor Who story.
We do.
The Power of the Doctor, which we did mention in the last episode. We had the title, didn't we, by then?
We did have the title by then, and a couple of screenshots and da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
But it all kicked off, was it Saturday, like Saturday lunchtime?
It did, I was out.
Yeah.
And then you messaged me saying, there are two TARDISes. And I was like, what are you on about?
What's really annoying me a little bit about the way that they put the stuff out is that the first thing that you see is the captioned trailer, which is squeezed into 4x3.
Yeah.
And it's got all the, you know, subtitly stuff. And it's like, that's fine, but you get about 25 seconds into it, after the shock of going like, oh, new trailer, look at all the stuff that's going on. And you're like, I'm seeing like half the picture.
Yeah.
And I'm missing half the images.
Because they've got all these words. Like, I get why they do it, because obviously it's eminently screen grabbable and then shareable, because it's got the caption in it.
And accessible.
And very accessible. I hadn't thought about that.
But it's still annoying.
It is still bloody annoying, you know.
God, we're really just picking
we really
things
are.
To take faults with.
It was terrible, I know. What's going
on? Let's talk about the trailer itself. So what were the big things that you took away from it? What were the things that you thought, didn't expect to see that, or that's intriguing?
I didn't expect it to be as much of a Dalek story as it seems to be.
Oh, yeah.
The Daleks seem to be a really big part of this, more so than I imagined.
Okay.
As do the Cybermen, I guess. You know, because I think it was sort of publicised, especially in like DWN, like this is the... I mean, obviously it's the Master's master plan. But I don't know, I just kind of expected it to be like... Sort of like with the Day of the Doctor, you know, that it's not really a Dalek story. They're in it just to bookend some Time War-y stuff.
Yeah.
But they just appear just to get blown up. And I kind of thought it might have been a little bit like that, but...
But I suppose that's the thing with these specials, though, is that you can't really quantify them as... It's something-centric story.
Like,
ultimately, it's a regeneration story, and that's the most important part of it.
Yeah.
I don't know if necessarily it's... Maybe it's just the way the trailer's cut, like the Dalek incursion of Earth is...
Yeah.
Whatever it says. Like, okay, that's part of the unfolding action in the last act.
Right, yeah.
And, you know, and here come the Cybermen.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
here come the Sontarans. And, you know, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But, it certainly seems like, I guess the Cybermen would, it seems to make logical sense for them to be...
Logical.
To be up there over the Daleks, considering it's Gallifrey, it's
yeah.
the Cybermasters, it's the
that
Master,
is true.
It's a Shard.
That is true.
So maybe that's a bit of a misdirect.
Yeah.
But...
I don't know. Maybe we've just got, like, Doomsday,
mm.
you know, the rematch.
Yeah, yeah,
maybe
possibly.
It's a bit like that. Because you've got two planets blasting at each other.
Mm.
You've got the Dalek Death Star,
yeah.
which is amazing, because when it fires that cannon, you can hear the Dalek
yeah,
blast
yeah.
in it. So yeah, Dalek Death Star, which was cool. And I think one of those planets is kind of Cyberman-y, because it's like blue.
Yes.
It's got blue lights on it, and that apparently means Cybermen these
that
days.
Everybody's saying is Gallifrey, but it's like a cyber-converted Gallifrey.
Oh, is that what they're saying?
I
saw it and went, oh, is that Mondas? Because it looks kind of Earth-like, and I thought, oh, twin
yeah,
planet.
Yeah, it's the same quarry from the Series 12 finale, though. Because everybody was going on about, they've gone back to the same location that they shot the confrontation between
oh,
13
oh,
and the
is
Master.
It? Oh, right, okay.
So apparently,
I had to really think then. I was like, what was Series 12?
I wouldn't have identified it.
No.
So,
that is cool,
mm.
but I don't think we can necessarily read into that too much. Because
no.
when it comes to Doctor Who,
and
a quarry is a quarry.
Yeah, it's a quarry is a quarry.
That's like going, oh, they're filming in the same Dorset quarry
yeah.
for Survival this year.
Yeah,
they
yeah.
must be going back to Seganax or whatever the planet is.
I think
is
it was that, and the fact that the kind of architecture is a bit spiry and looks a
right,
bit kind
I see.
Of Gallifrey
well, maybe,
and Capitoli.
Maybe, maybe it is. Maybe the Masters turned Gallifrey into...
The new Mondas.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody did suggest that second planet blasting Gallifrey, blasting Earth, could
yeah.
be Gallifrey.
Right, okay.
And it's like the Daleks have finally put a giant motor
into
a planet and are piloting around the galaxy.
I like to think that, because obviously the Cybermen had already mastered it. I put this in an action figure adventure, this little dig that the Cybermen were a bit better at that than the Daleks. But... I like to think that they're having, like, wacky races. They're like, right, start your engines. It's
who's
like
the
robot
first
wars,
that can get there?
Robot wars with planets. And it's just Daleks and Cybermen. We're like, well, oh, so we've got the Cybermen from Mondas over here. They've got a souped-up engine inside the planet's core. Meanwhile, the Daleks and Skaro have got a massive fuck-off cannon.
And then Craig Charles suddenly appears.
Yeah.
Coked out of his bin. All right, everybody, let's go. Let's do it. Let's do it. Let the wars begin. The other thing about the planets, which was interesting,
yeah.
was people bringing up Can You Hear Me?
Mm.
And the Eternals, and
yeah.
Zelin, and the
yeah.
other one that I can't remember the name of.
I can't remember anything of that story.
But you know that animation
that
people
do
have
remember
been sharing?
The animation,
and it's
yeah.
sort of, and then somebody also mentioned, because I can't remember if it got resolved, and I mean, me saying it out loud, expecting you to go, oh no, actually, I do know the answer to that. I don't know if it was resolved at all after it was mentioned in Spyfall Part 1, I think. But remember when they go into the Master's shack?
Yes.
Right, so you know he's got his, like, Wizard of Oz, you know when it's
spinning
outside?
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But when that's on the ground,
right,
they go in,
yeah.
and there's like a big projector, I think, or there's some drawings or something, but the Doctor's referring to something, she's looking at it, and it's multiple versions of Earth or multiple planets.
All right.
And some people are sort of going, well, that I don't think that got picked up on.
Oh,
so maybe
okay.
the fact there's multiple planets
oh, maybe.
Kind of firing at each other, it might be something similar. But when I saw that animation
yeah.
being called back, I thought, maybe we've been sleeping on a lot of stuff. Or maybe Chris was sleeping on a lot of potential
right.
and then rewatched everything and went, right, let's see if we can get that.
Binge watch his own series.
Well, you know.
Kiss my diss.
Well, it's been 5 years, 31 episodes in 5 years. You know, there's a lot to catch up on.
Sorry.
So yeah, I mean, did it increase your level of excitement and anticipation in the episode?
It did, because in the days leading up to the trailer being announced as coming out on Saturday, I thought to myself, I'm really only wanting to see the trailer for content for a podcast.
Sure.
I don't really give a shit.
Okay.
I saw, obviously, the picture of Ace
mm-hmm.
in her jacket, and I was just like, oh, that's amazing. That
oh,
is...
with the bat.
Yeah.
yeah.
I mean, honestly, really, I couldn't give a stuff that is a regeneration story. I couldn't give a stuff that is all these last people's stories. I'm really here for Tegan.
Yeah.
And particularly Ace. Mm. Because, you know, Ace didn't get an ending at all. Obviously, mm-hmm. Tegan had an ending. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't really know what happened to Ace. Point out, because I put a thing on Twitter saying, I've been waiting since I watched Survival on UK Gold in the 90s, to the wankers who then reply with, oh, she's been on Big Finish for the last 20 years. I don't give a shit. She's not been on the television.
Well, yeah, it's like, I think people forget that, what, maybe 5 to 10% of hardcore Doctor Who fans yes. actually consume all of that stuff.
Exactly.
So for most people watching it on telly, they're probably going to go,
yeah.
Who's that? But then some people are going to go, oh, she was with the... this is not my opinion, but the general public. She was with that shit... short Scottish one at the end. The one
I think I hear Jonathan running up the stairs trying to kill you.
Shit, the poison tits umbrella.
Umbrella, yeah.
I'm excited about them being in it. I'm excited for Tegan's closure.
I was going to say Tegan's clothes then.
Well, I mean, she looks pretty
She's
good.
She's got a good snazzy outfit, she does.
A snazzy outfit? Fucking Richard over it. It's a wonderful blouse you've got on. Yeah, I think that she's I'm looking forward to seeing how they play it.
Yeah, and how it all ties in.
And yeah, and how they're involved. But I mean, ultimately, I just think it's going to be we'll cut back to them every now and again and get a couple of cool fan like, oh wow, she's got a bat and oh they've got guns and oh that's a reference I get from The Visitation or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, that shot of Ace coming out in the parachute, yeah. I was like, oh, was that brilliant. Is good. That is good. And she's in Bristol. She was in Bristol. Museum.
She was in the museum.
Can
we
you believe
see if
it?
We can get in there and do our review of the episode in that room. That would be great. Just can we take that painting off the wall, please?
Yeah,
just to make
it
accurate.
Yeah.
So what do you think of the seismologist thing and the paintings thing? Because obviously it's a big feature-length special.
Yeah.
We are a year away, almost exactly, next month,
from
the 60th.
Yeah.
Which is only 10 years since the last major anniversary story, which also involved paintings.
Yes.
So, like, do we think that it's the Falls No More painting, or do you think it's the painting of Ace? Like...
I don't know.
It's all going to be...
I've not really given it that much thought,
no,
painting
sure.
thing.
I think it's all going to be fluff, goes... isn't it, around the edge? And then...
Yeah, I think it just... Just you chatting about Can You Hear Me and Spyfall and my brain thinking, what are these things?
Yeah.
I think that just shows my level of...
Yeah.
You know, involvement with this series.
Couldn't give a fuckedness of it all.
Yeah, really, basically.
Well, I mean, I think it's really impressive. Like, just in terms of, damn, what a seismic change a regeneration is, which is the thing that always excites me about these stories.
Yes.
That we are... sat in this room at the moment, as of recording this, Jodie Whittaker is still the Doctor.
Mm.
But the next time we're in here...
She won't be Doctor Who
anymore.
...to talk
about the episode, not only will she not be Doctor Who anymore, but we don't know who else is going to be Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Who is going to be...
You might be Doctor Who.
I might be, you never know. You know, who is going to be the Doctor the
not
next time
you would tell me.
You may well think that, but I couldn't possibly comment. Who's going to be Doctor Who when we're sat in here next?
Yeah.
But that is so exciting. People have been talking about looms on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that and Faction Paradox are two words that I will mute immediately when I get back on Twitter. I can't stick that stuff. Okay, fine. The looms might be interesting to 0.0002% of hardcore Doctor Who fans. Mm. For the general public, the excess of dialogue and setup that will require to talk about Time Lord heritage, lineage, biology, chemistry, and then what this fucking situation is the Doctor's in with this cubicle she's in. It's not going to happen. Although he has got 90 minutes to play with and, you know, he could do anything.
I mean, this is a man who did an episode that was 45 minutes worth of exposition, so I wouldn't put it past him to have the Master to come along and be like, oh, Doctor, I've put you in a loom.
And then
remember looms?
Oh, God.
Let me tell you about looms.
What do we think about the space train? Is that just an excuse to keep... Because Dan doesn't seem to be part of any of the main action.
No.
It's the Doctor and Yaz.
Yeah.
Who seem to be in the main... story.
Yeah, I mean, there's that, which I think is going to be a good set piece. Maybe it's going to be like a Bond film. It will start off with like a nice set piece on a train.
Like how Flux started.
Just like how Flux started.
Because that was really successful. That really set that series up really well.
And that looks great, and I think that looks fun. What I don't see anybody talking about is what the hell is that weird, like...
spindly thing.
Yeah, that sort of, I don't know, is that, jellyfish, starfish.
Is that time? Because we know that time was... And there's the whole thing about being erased.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Do you think that has more weight to it than people are giving it? Because it's just sort of like an, you know, a line of like, oh, Doctor, you know, you're going to get erased from history. It's like, how many times has the Doctor heard that? But do you think that that might have relevance to...
David Tennant.
What kind of comes after all of this?
Do you think they erased the last three regenerations?
What if they erased the last in everything? You know? Maybe, I don't know, does it play into Joe Martin's involvement somehow? Because something
maybe
come out
it creates
Twitter.
Like a divergent timeline where the 10th Doctor didn't regenerate.
And so he pops in.
And so he is the Doctor of this divergent timeline, and he has to fix it and put time back on course.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then...
with the assistance of a couple of other familiar faces next year.
Yeah.
Who also have two hearts.
Not Peter Capaldi.
You couldn't pay him to come back.
No, bless him.
Yeah, I don't know why I said that. It's the impression that I get.
Who knows? It might have been a red herring.
It may have... Yeah, it may. It may be. Yeah. And then obviously there's the two TARDISes. There's the TARDIS with the Joker.
Aha, the Joker. I didn't know he was going to be in it.
No, that's very, very bad wolf.
It is. I mean, I saw that and my immediate thought was, oh, the Joker.
and whether that's... there's a few things I will always ask you to not do again. Paul McGann's voice and that will be
and the
ones that forever. I'll be like...
Oh, I was going to go full Joker.
It just frightens me. Yeah.
Doctor, you've come into my new TARDIS.
Come into my what?
TARDIS.
Oh, at least you said TARDIS.
What did you think I said?
Well, I don't know. You're the Joker. You could be up to anything.
I could. You never know. Anyway, carry on, Billy.
I'll do the entire thing as Paul McCartney if you want me to. Just sweet revenge. I'm not going to do that.
A new podcast.
I won't. I won't.
The Joker and Paul McCartney.
That would be the original odd couple. Yeah.
One's a homicidal maniac.
And the other is the Joker. I'm really excited for it. I think that it's going to, you know, cause Twitter to have a couple of meltdowns probably along the way, as most Doctor Who does. Yeah. But, you know, I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
And the trailer has done enough to kind of...
This was the thing. I watched it and I thought, that looks really good. I'm looking forward to this. And then... I was immediately told Legend of the Sea Devils trailer was really good as well. That was shit. And I was like, well, yeah, that is true.
I know what you mean, but I kind of feel like there's more scope in this, that it's immediately, immediately
I feel like
supersedes
this was the
quality.
Episode that they had all the time and money spent on. And definitely. Then they were told, oh, actually, do you want to do another one?
Do you want to sneak one in between?
Yeah.
I think, yeah, I mean, that's sort of been the line that everybody's... Toad.
Yeah.
In relation to the origins of that episode. It's going to be really funny in 15 years' time when the news comes, you know, the story comes out and it turns out that's totally not true and it was always planned or whatever, you know, because, well, we'll see.
I think it was a complete cock-up.
Final predictions.
Final predictions. I don't know.
How's she going to cop it?
How is she going to cop it?
In that chamber, Yaz shoots her.
No, I don't
Dalek,
think. I don't
Cyberman,
think. I think we're supposed. I think we're supposed to think that she's going to cop it in that chamber, but I don't think she will. She does a good Yaz at the end.
Yeah, that was quite.
I
think it's because we've not heard her in that state.
Yeah.
Before.
Yeah, we've never really heard her sort of terrified.
No.
Terrified.
But
I mean,
it was
you
a great delivery.
Really do hear the Doctor terrified.
No.
Not generally speaking.
No. If that. I mean, I'm guessing her lips also said Yaz in that scene as well. But even if that line is from
I see.
That bit,
yeah.
You know what I mean?
I mean, the sound, it sounds...
muffled.
Yes!
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It's like she's in a glass...
Yeah, cabinet.
Yeah.
Fine. Yeah. I'm still of the...
You...
Fucking hell.
Dribbling all over the place.
Hey, we came out of the top of the thing. I am still of the mindset that I think Yaz is involved in her... in her death, brought on by the Master's influence. Because they mention, I think, that he's got control, like Rasputin has got control, mesmeric control over
people.
Yeah, like they're pulling on the hypnosis thing.
Because that's not even in the trailer. There's not really much of him as Rasputin in the trailer. But in the synopsis, it talks about him being, about him with the Tsar, you know, Tsar Nicholas II. And you're like, well, that's not even, you've not even seen that stuff.
But that,
it's going to be a fleeting thing, isn't it?
It's going to be like when the 11th Doctor's time hopping and meeting Stan and Ollie and rapping and
Don't remind me, please.
Hey, look, enjoy the rest of the video anyway. Enjoy Power of the Doctor, more importantly. Have fun. Don't hurt each other on the internet. It's not worth it. It's just a TV show at the end of the day. Farewell, Jodie Whittaker.
Farewell to all those props that have been sold off and, for Children in Need. Have you not seen all these props going for Children in Need?
That they're getting rid of the paradigm.
If you go on eBay, it is literally the contents of a BBC skip everything from the last few series.
Wow.
They're selling like TARDIS roundels from Jodie's TARDIS.
Wow.
All sorts of bits and bobs.
They're
selling, from End of Time, the lovely lady, June
Whitfield?
Yes. They're selling her mobile phone from that story. So if you want Minnie's phone.
Yeah.
Which has groped David Tennant's arse, then held a mobile phone. So there you are. There's some weird
15 years ago.
By proxy
arse. David Tennant arse grabbing.
It could be yours.
It could be yours.
Not that we should probably be promoting the. Is it probably bad that we promote them selling BBC property? Because I guess it was
It's going to Children in Need, isn't it? Well, or is this stuff that's been sold on?
On the eBay. Oh,
okay,
eBay
don't go on eBay. Don't do that stuff.
Yeah, but if you go on Children in Need's auction, they're selling Cybermen suits from the Pandora Opens and all that stuff. And
wow.
Paradigm Daleks, which is the... I love it because as soon as I saw it up for auction, I was like, that is the BBC saying we are never seeing these fucking Daleks ever again.
Yeah. Did you see the state that one was in? It was like basically a Dalek spine and a bit of a skirt.
Yeah.
Oh, bless.
It's a real state.
So obviously, next episode is going to be Power of the Doctor. Our review for that.
God.
Which is so exciting. And then we will have the Whittaker era thing, the wrap up.
Yeah.
Which you can get your last minute votes in for that in the link below. That will close this Friday, so the day after this episode first goes out. Exciting stuff.
Very good, very good. And also, we should point out, because I think you pointed out on Twitter, Christmas Day, Doctor Who.
So the BBC News article that sort of came along with the trailer that said Jodie Whittaker's leaving, mentioned that there's specials starting this year.
Mm.
So we know that obviously some of the specials material is set at Christmas.
Yeah.
So Christmas or New Year special.
Yeah. I think that's what we kind of thought, wasn't it, really?
I kind of went along with it, but I didn't really believe it until... I thought Easter, summer, or Easter... 60th anniversary, and then maybe Christmas next year.
Right.
And then shooty starts March, April 2024.
Hmm.
But, I mean, it does make sense, actually, the lack of promotion for this, if the new Who is so quick on its heels.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm not, you know, this is all very conspiracy theory, and I don't agree with this line of thinking, because I'm a fan of the current version of the show.
Yeah.
But it's almost as if you were to be really cynical about it, it's like, well, Russell's coming in and he's changing the game.
Yeah.
If we promote this one too much,
yeah,
then people are going to think it's just going to be the same thing when it comes back at Christmas.
Yeah.
So maybe it's like, well, you know, and we've been saying it all along. It has felt like, let's get it out of the way.
Yeah.
And then we'll move on to the good stuff.
I sort of said they kind of buried it a little bit, didn't they?
Yeah, but I did air quotation marks when I said better, by the way, audio listeners, just so you know.
Maybe. I don't know. I do get a sense of that.
But I mean, that kind of speaks to the lack of promotion generally.
Yeah,
It's not like it's been any different to the trailer when it came out for Eve of the Daleks or whatever.
No. Yeah, I mean, like, if you compare this to, like, Flux. Flux, which had this massive campaign.
Mm. But the trailer still only... The release date was only announced 12 days before that series started.
Was it really?
At least this was, like, 19, 20 days.
But I guess it's just flux. They created more of a hubbub.
Sure. Because it was a full series. It's like 6 weeks worth of investment and airtime. So it makes sense. But we are standing on the frontier, the wild frontier of brand new Doctor Who. Everything changes.
That's going to be that evening. God, dear, that's very exciting. I think that's what's more exciting is thinking, right, well, what comes next?
Well, that's always
how does it all...
the most exciting thing about a regeneration. Yeah. It's like, how are they going to cop it? You know, you have a good adventure before, all the references, chock full of references, returning characters, you're going to get all of that in this story. Whether or not the plot or the story or the structure of it holds up under that weight obviously remains to be seen.
Yeah.
We sincerely hope it does, even just to serve Jodie well as she heads off.
Yeah, yeah.
So fingers crossed, everybody. But in the meantime, enjoy this interview with Matthew Jacobs and Vanessa Yule talking about Doctor Who Am I. It's a really good chat. Please stick around and enjoy the rest of that. And we will see you next time on The Power of the Doctor.
We have a couple of guests, don't we, Billy?
We do. Joining us to talk about their brand new film, Doctor Who Am I, we are joined by Matthew Jacobs, writer and co-producer and co-director of this project, but writer and co-producer of the Doctor Who TV movie, and Vanessa Yule, who is also the co-director of Doctor Who Am I. How are you doing, guys? Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Doing well.
Great to see you too. Thanks for having us today. This is an honour.
Oh, thanks for coming on. This is very exciting
for us. It is very exciting for us. Now, you guys gave us a preview screener of the movie that we've watched. It is absolutely fantastic. And as someone who kind of works in fact-tent and observational documentary, it's amazing to see such a great documentary made about our kind of weird community, you know?
Yeah, and very honest as well.
Very honest, blisteringly so.
Thank you. Blisteringly honest. I want to put that on the poster.
Yeah, I'll write that one down.
Yeah, if you've got enough time to get it on there, that'd be brilliant. So we've got a bunch of questions to run through you guys. Firstly, for the pair of you, how are you both feeling about the imminent release of the documentary? Vanessa, how are you feeling about it?
It's unbelievable. Every time I hear someone say that they liked it or even that they watched it and liked it, I'm just like, it warms a part of my soul so much. work and energy and parts of so much of ourselves are in the movie. You've seen Matt give it his all. That it's unbelievable. It's been quite a journey, I think, for both of us that we're just, it's unreal at this point. Hasn't sunk in totally yet.
Nice. And what about you, Matthew?
Well, I think it's tremendously exciting. I mean, one of the things that's most exciting about it is that, you know, this is Vanessa's first feature film. And I'm what Americans call a veteran. and the fact that we've been making, it's the end of a long journey. So we're very happy. Each day I find a new thing to celebrate in terms of getting to the end of this journey. We've got the American premieres start next week at Newport Beach Film Festival and then Portland Film Festival. And that's fantastic because a lot of those people that you saw in the documentary, they're going to be able to come along and see them, you know, and see themselves properly, but not just up in a convention setting. They'll see themselves, you know, in a big cinema, in a cinematic setting. And we're so excited about the UK release. I think Kaleidoscope are doing a fantastic job in terms of saying, let's do these special nights at View Cinemas where fans can come. So it's only on for like one night or two nights in the cinemas, but it's still a cinematic release. But what we're hoping is that we'll create enough of a buzz that some other cinemas will just call up and say, can we run it for a week or something like that? Which would be great.
But just the fact that there is a theatrical release of this documentary,
brilliant.
Neither of us thought that would really ever happened. So yeah. We're just over the moon. It's exciting. Very exciting.
That's fantastic. Because I actually went online to see, is it showing anywhere near me? And we live in Bristol. We're in the southwest of England. Cardiff is only a stone's throw away. And I found that there was a screening on the same day in Bristol and in Cardiff. So if anybody does want to go and see the movie, I'm sure within a fair radius, you'll be able to get down to a cinema and find it and be able to watch it, which is really exciting.
Yeah, at the moment it's about 14 cinemas in all. I think maybe 12 or 13 on the 27th, and then the other cinemas are showing it on odd days after. I mean, cinemas can call and say, you know, can get in touch with Kaleidoscope if there's a demand, and they, you know, they don't charge that much in terms of viewing. I think it's eminently doable if people want to watch it, because as you could see watching it, it's very much a film about community, and when you watch it with an audience, you're going to be surprised, because there's big laughs. I mean, sort of really big laughs, and then it gets quite intense, as you saw.
How long was the process of making this film? Because we were trying to work out, looking at the convention, like, well, what sort of year did this all start? I mean, we think it was probably before COVID.
Yes. Oh, definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, we started filming in 2015 in Gallifrey. I mean, there were some mentions of dates, and we tried to, like, remove those dates. There's, like, a couple instances. But the main filming was in 2015, some in 2016, and then we even filmed more... like Eric Roberts, it took us a while to get to him, and that was in
2018 or 19. I don't know, the years are a blur.
Yeah, it's a blur. Maybe it was 19. No, 18. It was 18.
I mean, it was funny. Oh, go on, Matthew. Sorry.
It is funny because lots of people do this. They set out, they say, oh, I'm going to make a documentary about my cat. Or I'm going to make a documentary about, you know, the meaning of life, or both. And then they start on these journeys. And we're very proud of the fact that we finally got to the end. And then Sci-Fi London Film Festival, they actually watched it through. The problem when you make these documentaries is they go out, and at the festivals, they'll watch the first 10 minutes. And if it's not exactly what they're after, they don't watch the rest of it. That's basically what happens, unless you've got some form of IP behind you. But, well, we had an IP behind us, but still people weren't really watching it. And then it was Louis Savvy at Sci-Fi London Film Festival, who had, one of his programmers was a Matt Keane Doctor Who fan, and she watched it all the way through, and she said, you have to watch it. And he was going, oh, I don't like Doctor Who, you know. and he watched it, and he got to the end, and he said this when he introduced the film, that he wasn't a Doctor Who fan, but when he watched it through, the film is about so much more than the TV show. You know, if we'd have made this film at the BBC, it would have had to have been about the TV show. It would have had to have been a thing of promotion, whereas we've actually ended up making a film that's something else. So once people started watching it through and getting to the end of it, which they're meant to do when you pay your entry fee to go to these festivals, they started saying yes. Then Melbourne said yes.
Newport, well, it was the same week that Melbourne and Sci-Fi London said yes, after a slew of rejections, including like my hometown and everything else. And I was just like crestfallen, thinking nobody was going to see our documentary ever. But then, yeah, London Sci-Fi and Melbourne were in the same week. And it was like, oh, people will watch it. Yay.
It's kind of a feel good film. That's the idea. But at the same time, hopefully, it's blisteringly honest.
I love it. Thank you very much. Every mention of blisteringly honest, I'm going to ask for a commission. But
yes, every time you do it, you're going to get advertising. Gosh.
So, Vanessa, what was it that interested you in this story as someone who wasn't a Doctor Who fan?
Well, it started really with just our friendship. I mean, Matthew and I have worked together before. I worked on two of his previous features, and we're just sort of friends. So I had no idea that he wrote Doctor Who, let alone the Eighth Doctor. So when I found out, I was like, oh my God, like what? It just blew my mind. And he had been getting invited to 50th anniversary events. And that's when it sort of just, it came together. He said he was being invited to Doctor Who events, one in Florida. And I'm like, what are you talking about? We need to start filming this. And so it just sort of went from there. I knew Doctor Who from the 80s in the US, and I have nostalgic memories of it. And I don't know, it just sort of really started with just Matthew and going, it'll be another adventure for us to embark on. Little did we know it would take forever.
I love that.
We thought we'd be done in a couple of days because I got invited initially to an insane convention that kind of got cancelled. The guy who ran the convention ran off with the money.
Jacksonville, Florida.
Worried
about alligators.
Yeah, I thought there'd be crocodiles and Doctor Who fans and Doctor Puppet and all these weird things, and it was just like a different world. Anyway, that when that collapsed, it all spread across the internet, and they said, you know, and at that point, Sean Lyon, who runs Gallifrey One, which is the biggest dedicated Doctor Who convention, certainly in America, he then got on the phone and said, you know, you should come. We didn't even realize you were here, Matthew. You know, normally we don't fly writers. so we didn't realize you were here, but we will fly you down from San Francisco. So I said, well, by that time, Vanessa and I had thought we wanted to do this film. And so I said, well, yes, but if you can just basically give us permission to make this film, give rooms for the crew and things like that. And then they put us in touch with Daphne Ashbrook. And Daphne was, have you met and spoken to Daphne yet?
No, we haven't.
Oh, she's wonderful.
She's fantastic. She's, you know, she plays Dr. Grace Holloway in the TV movie. And she got us in touch with all the Uber fans and became our sort of guide, if you like. And so a lot of the fans that you see there are because of being introduced to us by Daphne. And then we did that thing at Gallifrey. And then we went and filmed in fans' homes from there. And then in the fall, we went to Long Island, New York, to the Long L.I. Who Fest convention. And that was a big convention. And we filmed there. And then I did some pickups the following year back there just to get some shots that we hadn't got. And we carried on filming.
Yeah, it just took a while. Especially neither of us had edited a I mean, I have never edited a feature before. And so it just took a while to just wrap your head around having all of this footage and what is the story.
Yeah.
And we were sort of had some rough cuts together, but Matthew was very adamant that I had to put my own spin on the film. I had to put my touch on it. And he gave me a lot of trust in doing that. I ended up quitting my job to take several months off to work on the film. So we finally, after several months, kind of got it to its rough shape, and we were able to say, oh, this works. And then from there, we got some other feedback. We had test screenings. How do we make the story better? It was like quite a long process. And it's very difficult to be working full time and then trying to like cut a feature. I'm sure people do it, but my head couldn't handle it. So it was like, okay, bye-bye job. I'm going to like work on this. And it was, it was a process, but happy at
the process. The yeah. We had wonderful advice from a manager, producer called Lee Stobie, who'd become my manager at that time. He came in and gave us some good, he loved the project. And he said, well, you should move this here. And that helped. And then we met with Colin Vaines. Colin Vaines is a well-known producer who did things like My Week with Marilyn, Gangs of New York, all sorts of that. And he knew me from way back. And he looked at it and he gave advice as well. So you pick up advice where you can, you try your film out, and eventually you go, this is kind of working. We should finish it. And then of course COVID came along, and at that point suddenly the industry was kind of out of work here in LA, and a lot of people were sitting around, and that was when we just decided to just go for it. And Vanessa basically, you know, has sort of been the main producer, putting in some money so that we could get people to do what score, like Mark Leggett did the score and Dave Eichhorn did the sound, and people were doing that, but they were doing it so
and
low.
And also a shout out to David Burgess. So saw the opening, animation sequence.
Yeah, we love Dave. Yeah,
he's a friend of the podcast.
Yes,
yeah.
We were just searching the internet. We're like, it would be great if we had a Doctor Who fan involved in the artwork, and he just sort of popped up. And he was just fantastic. And so he came on board. And
he just left. Sorry, he just left university. And so we'd have these video conferences with him in his bedroom. And he's going, Mom, I'm coming down.
It wasn't that.
It was funny, though.
Exceptionally talented, gave it his all. And that opening sequence, because we were just wondering how the hell are we going to pull this off?
Yeah.
And he came guns blazing or whatever. He just he gave it his all, and I'm so excited he gets to see that on the big screen.
That's fantastic, Matthew. Obviously, the impetus for doing these conventions for you was partly to cover your experiences on the documentary. But what was it at that moment that made you kind of turn around and think, actually, I'll embrace this community a little bit more?
When I realized it wasn't really about the show, it's interesting. You know what I mean? When I realized that this was a family, and also as you see in the film, it takes me a while, but I recognize that I'm just as much part of that family, and that not apart from being a filmmaker, a writer, director, actor thing. Yeah, apart from all of that, it's part of me that really loves watching stuff, and gets a tremendous amount out of it. And realizing that was kind of cathartic. And at that point, I think, and that happened when we were in Long Island. Really, there was they had this panel on the gunfighters, and suddenly I was really scared. I was really frightened about doing it because I couldn't work out why. And really, it's because I was all connected with my father, because my father played Doc Holliday. All sorts of stuff was coming up to the surface. So it was quite life-changing in that respect. But Vanessa recognized it straight away. It was like we were down at the Paul McGann birthday party, and I was kind of saying, after this, I've got to go and do this other thing. And Vanessa said, hold that thought. And then she took Dylan Glockler and the team up to our hotel, up to our room. And she said, you come up here in what, 20 minutes or something, or half
an hour?
10
minutes. We're going to be ready. 10 minutes.
We're going to be ready in 10 minutes. And I'm down there with my phone. And I'm thinking, we should be covering Paul's birthday. And I'm rushing around trying to sort of film him. And then I get back up to the room. By that time, Vanessa had kind of sort of convinced me that the film would be more about me than I wanted it to be. I wasn't quite.
No.
Yeah. No, you're right.
No.
I wasn't. But that was the moment where in answer to your question, that it was around that turning point. As we came away from that convention, we kind of, up until then, we'd be going to people saying, tell us, who is the Doctor Who in you? Question which we occasionally get some answers to, but it's not, it's kind of a bit of a bore.
We got a lot of great answers. It's just, you have so many, we met so many wonderful people, and they all told us their stories.
Oh, I'm not saying that was boring.
I know, but it's just, how do you string that together? You need like a framework, and you're the framework through which we meet everyone.
Right.
And we get our little nuggets of, we learn something, a little bit of something from every person we meet in the documentary. And that it sort of culminates, and you kind of, by the end or the moment of Matthew's realization, it's like we've already learned all these little nuggets of why people are fans or what they're looking for, and that kind of gets to the point where it strikes chord with you.
Fantastic. Matthew, you were talking about the gunfighters, and you bring up your experience of watching your father in the gunfighters a lot during the film. Did you stick with Doctor Who before it came back in 96 as a job? Did you carry on watching it?
Not really. I was, you know, I think I would follow Patrick Troughton. I was still into it then. And then I went on to, you know, other stuff. And I really hadn't been following Doctor Who that much. So when they came to me in 96, you know, saying, would I pitch? Then I sort of really dug into what I thought it meant to me. And so it was a very honest pitch. Doctor Who Am I was the pitch. That was, because you remember, so how he has to find out who he is so he can save the world, basically. Everybody warmed to that. Then I just loved writing it. You know, what can I say? But yeah, Patrick Troughton, I suppose I followed him, and a little bit and a little bit of definitely chunks of Sylvester's stuff. I mean I love Sylvester's Doctor. I like them all, really. I mean, I'm pretty, you know, Catholic taste, as they say.
Vanessa, one of the coolest aspects for us as UK fans is seeing the American convention circuit, seeing what those people are like. Before going along and shooting at Long Island and Gallifrey One, did you have any preconceptions about what that experience will be like, what the people will be like, and which of those preconceptions stuck and which one of those was shattered?
Well, being an American, we generally like dressing up and do, you know, whatever else. So I was excited. I really didn't have, I maybe if anything, because I'd only talked to Matthew, I would be just like, oh, are they really going to come after
right,
him with
right.
like, pitchforks? Like, is it really going to be that awful? So I was excited to see that. And there was some stabbing, but, you know, for the most part, everyone was lovely and wonderful. I love the cosplay and everything else. I'm not exactly a stranger to fandom or, you know, nerdy, fun, amazing things. So I was just thrilled. I was excited. I was ready for anything. And if Matthew is going to, you know, be cornered, I would be there behind the camera. Yeah. So it was fun.
Fantastic. So going back to the film, the TV movie, because I'm sure a lot of people listening are going to want to hear a little bit about the TV movie.
Sure.
How did that come about, Matthew? How did you get involved in that project?
I'd been working for all of the people who were trying to make that project. So I'd been working indirectly for Amblin by doing Young Indiana Jones. I knew Trevor Walton. And I'd obviously done quite a bit of stuff for the BBC by then. And I was used to handling franchise things with Lassie and Emperor's New Groove and, you know, sort of quite heavy stuff that I was already writing by then. So it was a very simple thing. Their series pilot attempt had failed at Universal, so they needed to start again. And at that point, Trevor and a couple of other people suggested my name. My name came up, and so they were sort of. So it was very simple. My agent here at ICM reached out to me and said, "Do you want to do Doctor Who?" And I just said yes. And then they said, "Well, you must go along and meet Phil Siegel." So I then went to meet with Philip Siegel, and Philip didn't know that I was as British as I am. It was kind of like that. So, and he didn't know, he certainly didn't know about my connection with the gunfighters and my father, Anthony Jacobs. And so as soon as he heard that, he felt very confident. And then I basically gave a very simple pitch, very clean pitch, which everybody could sign off on. And then it was really quite quick. It was only a few months of writing before it was greenlit. And then, like all productions, it's sort of blinking green light. Sometimes it was on, sometimes it was off. And then before the end of the year, we started shooting up in Vancouver. So after all of, you know, so it's interesting. Our little documentary has taken 7 years to sort of really get to the screen. The TV movie took 7 years of hard work to get to the screen. And that's what the 7 year hitch is about, that documentary. So there must be something. So I'm hoping I live another 7 years. and maybe there'll be something else.
There's an interesting bit. We've got the book as it features in the documentary itself.
It's a good book.
It's a fantastic book by Philip Siegel with Gary Russell. There's an element mentioned in here, I think, about an old version of the story that involves Halloween, the master bringing the undead to life. Any elements of those kind of original versions of the story you wish had maybe creeped into the script or anything like that?
Well, it was absolutely verboten for me to look at any of the previous writers' works. So they'd done that, they said, we're not going to let you read any of the other, right? They'd had about six or seven writers. There's an interesting book called The Nth Doctor, written by Lefissier, who was the then head of fans in America. And he goes into detail. And it's an entire book where they're comparing every previous script to my script. And yet the people who wrote the book never contacted me ever. So it was a fascinating read. For me, it was an eye-opener. My only thoughts about the other scripts was that when it came to the WGA, the Writers Guild of America arbitration, which has to happen here it's very simple. If there's more than three writers who've been involved, then it goes to arbitration, and the guild reads everything. It's a horrible job if you get landed with it. Suddenly you have to read 20 drafts or 30 drafts of the project. And then every writer says what credit they think they should get.
Wow.
And I said, oh, well, I should get the writing credit on this. I didn't read anybody else's work. And it's all based on previous doc. That's the previous doctor material. And the Writers Guild agreed that none of the other writers' stuff that was original to them remained. But obviously, there's a filtration that happens because Philip Siegel had supervised all those different drafts. So I think there are things in the finished movie that, you know, could be said to have come from previous ideas.
So you mentioned earlier about having worked on things like Lassie and the Young Indiana Jones adventures. You know, how did working on Doctor Who compare to the other big Hollywood franchises?
Obviously, Doctor Who was a personal thing. Whereas trying to write Lassie, well, I made Lassie into a personal thing. I actually, whenever I sit down with a project, and I think most decent writers will do this, they say, and most actors do it, what bit of my experience of the world can I bring to the table? But with Doctor Who, it differed because I was bringing something that was so integral to my childhood that it was just actually a joy to write. So it was more joyful than writing Lassie, which is, at the end of the day, is, you know, is Lassie. What can you do? And likewise, you know, others. And certainly if you're writing for Disney, you know, it's you're writing within such a finite genre that it inevitably becomes generic. And you end up having to toe the line. And there's, you know, you might come up with an original concept and something like that, but then suddenly there are 30 writers in the room and they're all throwing paint at the wall.
Was writing the TV movie more stressful, or like, because there are so many other things going on behind the scenes, or is like every movie, every franchise kind of has their own stress level trying to please everyone?
I think every franchise has its own stress level. I don't envy anybody who has to take over the Doctor Who franchise. My heart goes out to Chris Chibnall. Seriously.
Of course,
he's done his best, and you know, 7 years from now, he's going to be making a documentary like us. Sure. You know, it's a vicious circle. When you deal with a franchise that you're reviving, be it Candyman or whatever, the expectations are legion. And I think that's the thing that you have to, in a way, not think about as you sit down to it. You just do your best. Vanessa, it really is that. It's a challenge, no matter what you do.
You start by laying the film out. It's very, very timely that we should come on to this point, actually. You lay out at the start of the movie, this movie, Doctor Who Am I, the two sticking points the fans had were the Doctor has a smoochy smooch, which, to be honest, by modern standards of Doctor Who, is unbearably tame. Mm. You know, like, compared to what we sort of later on in the programme's history, it's nothing.
Yeah.
The other one, of course, as you mentioned, is the Doctor being half-human. And we have not escaped from the period where Doctor Who fans are annoyed by very contentious issues. Obviously, you mentioned Chris Chibnall. With him, we've had the Timeless Children. Previously, with Russell, we had the Time War and the creation of the Time War. In making this, did you get closer to sort of understanding why it is that fans really take that change to heart?
I think you could answer that, Vanessa, just as well as I could, because I think we both started to see that.
I guess it just depends. We've met people who flat out say they do not like that the Doctor is half human. It's just not possible. But then I've heard, you know, Matthew's reasons why the Doctor can be half human. He stands by it. I guess for me, I'm like, I think it's a personal choice. I don't know if I'm any closer to answering why it's such a sort of divisive moment or choice, but I'm just more like, okay, that can work. How is it going to tie into the story? Or is Doctor Who, and you can just sort of ignore it, and it'll just become its own little thing. So I don't know, Matthew, do you have
I think that the joy of the show, that one of the reasons the show is so enduring, is that it was conceived without a Bible. There were no test, there were no commandments. And that's why it was such a fertile place for people like Douglas Adams in the 60s and the 50s. Do you know what I mean? In the 60s and 70s. People were able to come and bring ideas to the table. And I knew that when I sat down to do it. And I think that was why I thought, you know, listen, I really do feel like he's half human. It's a childish perception. Later on, the fans don't like it because it's a bit like Spock, I suppose, in Star Trek, and they found it was sort of pandering to the way in which American entertainment sometimes really panders to trying to make characters very sympathetic rather than anti-heroes. Not so much recently. You've got shows like Breaking Bad. You've got great shows where you have central characters who are anti-heroes. So I think maybe people wanted Doctor Who to be different, and making the Doctor half human was a way of normalizing him that they didn't like. Having the Doctor kiss suddenly was like normalizing him. As my brother said to me, he said, it's heteronormative, something like that. And I went, what? And then I realized, yes, there's the nice thing about the Doctor is I not only identify with his strangeness, but you can identify, he's an open door. So as we've, been going down this road recently, so that applies in terms of sexuality as well. Sexually, he can be any sex. His sexuality can be anything. And I think that freedom should be celebrated rather than creating a clan. You know, we're the clan of, it only needs to be a male doctor. Can't be a female doctor.
Right.
You know, can't be gay. Can't be this. You know what I mean? But it's just a reflection of society at the end of the day, isn't it?
There was a sequence in the documentary where you visit a couple of fans, and one of them is quite confrontational about the half-human and the snogging thing. And, I mean, I was certainly quite taken aback seeing it, because, I mean, I don't know if this is the British versus American fan thing that maybe...
We let that aggravation stew
inside of
us.
Yes, and we're very polite about it.
That was Kevin Kittredge. Kevin and Bob, who are wonderful, two wonderful fans. And the nice thing about Kevin is he was funny about it. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like he was hurt. But right. He did say, just a little bit, I destroyed his childhood. and things like that. So, but there's a good humour behind people when they're criticizing, and it took me by surprise actually how good humoured everybody was. So I was like I'm like the villain of the piece really for the first third of the movie. You know I'm sitting there saying awful things, threatening to draw penises on fans' treasured mementos. You know what I mean? It's not good. I'm trashing other producers. I'm saying stuff. I mean, I really look like a shit for a while in the movie, yeah.
But it's funny.
Exactly.
It's very funny.
Vanessa, you mentioned in the film that your dad was a Trekkie, and I just wondered if that experience helped you know, give you that groundwork and that foundation to sort of get into the minds of Doctor Who fans or people who are obsessed over a particular thing. Like, to what degree was your dad a Trekkie? Was he donning, Starfleet uniforms and going to conventions?
That would have been hilarious. My pocket protector wearing dad. No, he never dressed up in any of that, but he did introduce me to Doctor Who in the 80s. So that's why I knew of the show. I mean, it had come back, but I didn't watch it in 2005. Tom Baker, totally remember him. My dad was super excited about this quirky British show. And so we would watch that. But no, he was always into science fiction. My undergrad was astronomy, so I was kind of like, you know, wanted to study the sciences. I think it was really just an interest in science and the books and the ideas of, like, you know, Arthur C. Clarke or space travel. We're going to mine asteroids and all of these things, which were all great and based in science fiction and kind of coming true. So I think, yes, that had helped me get into the mindset. I loved X-Files. I almost went to a Star Trek convention years ago and I couldn't because of school. And I was like, Mom, but I want to go. So I just like the idea of celebrating those pop culture things, however it is, dressing up or whatever else. I was surprised, like, you asked me about something I found surprising about the Doctor Who fandom, but I'm sure this happens across the board, is the creativity, like the people, the Doctor Who bake-offs or, like, you know, the little trinkets and jewelry that people make and stuff like that. I just found all of that absolutely fascinating, or people who just make like Doctor Who music and this Doctor Shy Guy or something on YouTube who does just stuff. And I'm just like, that's fascinating. And I love that creative outlet that people have in whatever fandom it is.
Yeah, I think that's something that comes across in the film because, as you said, people really go, you know, for it when they put their costumes on. Yeah. And I love the description. I think it's from the lady who drives the TARDIS across the US, where she says British conventions are like you've rounded up a bunch of people at a bus stop and shoved them into like a hotel lobby. And it's like, it is, you know, but the people that really go the extra length, like there's that regeneration fairy, there's the Minotaur, like, it, you know, it's a whole other level of creativity and ownership of it, which makes it really interesting to us because the American audience kind of have to make it their own because they don't get the benefit that we do of just it being omnipotent. And, you know, we have blue police boxes in London, you know, and Glasgow and stuff. It just kind of makes sense to us, it just being around. But
I mean, Matthew and I were lucky. 2019, we went to Comic-Con in San Diego and showed like a little trailer. And it was Comic-Con is just ginormous compared to even the fan conventions we went to, which were large, you know, several you know, 3,000 people or so, but Comic-Con, it was just like an industry. But some of the cosplay that we saw there was also just insane, just how much money people were putting into these things that are like 15 feet hot tall or something like that. And I'm just like, all right, this is pretty incredible. Go big or go home. That's kind of like the American way, I guess.
There's a pageantry element to it. It's almost medieval. It's in as much as it's, you know, you would have people doing processions and celebrations now, given a religious context, you know, in medieval times and in Tudor times and whatever. But now that religious context has gone been replaced by different culture.
Wait, so are you saying that people do look like they've been rounded up at a bus stop, or is there more are there more t-shirts happening? Is there more?
I think there is some more cosplay, isn't there?
I mean,
in the UK? A little bit more?
There is. I mean, I feel like out of 10 people, 3 to 4 of them might be in cosplay, and that varies from I've got a scarf on through to this is an inch perfect Sylvester McCoy costume. And everybody else,
right.
Some people have turned up to Doctor Who conventions in Blake Seven and Star Trek t-shirts.
Yeah.
Because they're like, what is going on here? Yeah. You know, but
how dare they?
I know, it's disgusting. I tried to hoof them out as soon as possible, but
I think I've been guilty of that one, to be honest. So, Matthew, now that it's been such a long period since 1996, I mean, I was 4 when the TV movie came out. I mean, I can remember my brother coming home with the VHS and us sitting down to watch it. How do you feel about the film now, looking back on it as a professional piece of work? What are your opinions?
We watched it at BritCon in Seattle. They have a convention, and they did a special convention that really focused on the TV movie. And so about a month ago, we watched it with Paul McGann, with Eric Roberts, sitting there. We were meant to be talking through it. We were meant to be doing a sort of live commentary on it as it happened. But Paul, I realized then that Paul had barely even seen the movie. He really doesn't like watching stuff that he's in. And I don't think Eric Roberts had seen it at all. Because,
that doesn't
you know, Eliza
me,
is afterwards the same. Was saying, he plays the master, it was, you know, was saying, can we get a copy, you know, after anyway, we watched it. So we started talking a little bit, but then we stopped talking. The audience really went with it. It plays much better. It's like a wine. It's gotten better with old age, you know. And there's a lot of ridiculous dialogue, but it's said so fast and so convincingly by Paul that you believe it, you know. I stand by everything I wrote, but definitely there are parts of it that come over like a sort of 1940s madcap kind of rom-com and Daphne, she just stole the show when we saw it recently, because there she was in front of an American audience. She's an American character. Her speed and wit, and the fact that how she sits in the audience's shoes. As all this stuff is going on around her, and I use the word shoes, you know, because of the shoe scene, really, and the people think of those elements. So there's a sort of 40s kind of like feel to the pace of the dialogue, which wasn't popular at that time. At that time, in the 90s, in the mid 90s, BBC were doing shows where people were, you know, monosyllabic speeches. Very Pinteresque, you know, and so suddenly the BBC see my kind of florid script with the sort of Noel Coward-ish kind of lines for the Doctor or you know, Oscar Wilde, you know, the life is wasted on the living, you know, and all that sort of stuff. They would look at that and go, no, you've got to cut it down, Matthew. You can't have car chases. I'd cut it down. But then Eric Roberts would come back and say, oh, I want to say that stuff. And Jeffrey just embraced the whole thing. So my feeling about, I have very fond feelings about the TV movie. You know, I was worried about watching it again recently. And we enjoyed watching it, didn't we, Vanessa? It was kind of a joyous thing.
I think also there was a panel at the end where everyone was on. It was Eric Roberts, Eliza, Jeremy Raddick, Paul, Phil Siegel, Matthew, and it was just this whole, it was like a sort of a dysfunctional family that had not talked to each other in a long time. But a lot of things were coming out, but it was just, everyone loved the project and loved being there. But it was, I think, one of the most fascinating panels on there. Everyone just bouncing off of each other a bit. It was fascinating. And have a big show with everyone.
I wanted to ask you about that, Vanessa, because one of the favourite parts of the film for me is there's a lovely shot of Daphne holding court on a panel, and Paul is sat next to him, sat next to her, and his face, he's just beaming at her. Like, you know, I've seen him smile at conventions before, but I've not seen a smile like that before. It's really lovely. So what did you take out of it as an experience for the actors, for the people that are attending them as guests? Like, what did you take away from that?
Oh, you mean just sort of like the interaction between the guests and the stars?
Yeah, and kind of like, because obviously it's made out, you know, they're a big family and all that kind of stuff, but there is an admission that I get to sit here, somebody pays $15 and tells me how brilliant I am, and then goes away. And that's a very honest way of putting it. I'm not sure that it's been put across that honestly before, which is great, because fundamentally, that is what it is. So, you know, was that a surprise to you, that sort of way of thinking of it, or the genuine adoration, the way that people absorb that affection?
I think it's a little bit of both, because it is a strange interaction of paying for a picture, but there is, I signed my first like poster at BritCon, so it's the first time I was experiencing it versus watching it. And it's sort of this process that both sides kind of understand. So it's sort of like, this is how it goes, but the actual joy that people get from meeting, you know, Matthew or Eric Roberts or whoever else. I mean, that's very, very genuine. And they're very happy and thrilled to have that FaceTime. So, I mean, I guess if that's just kind of how the convention industry works, I guess it's also a way to keep order, I suppose. It's fascinating, sort of weird, but I think the feeling, it's really nice to see how happy people are when they get to meet their heroes.
Love it. Superb.
Central to the film is the emotional journey that you go on, Matthew, and that you look at the idea that all these big franchises can provide some sort of respite when you're going through difficult times. What respite did you sort of get from attending the cons, and, you know, what was that emotional journey like for you?
Well, I think I say it in the film, it was finding a family, really, that I didn't realize was there. I think that's really it. You know, it's like, you don't expect sometimes to find a family. You can find a family in the weirdest of places sometimes. So for me, I think that was the biggest kind of revelation, was that this was a family that were accepting. I mean, here's the thing, is when you're with a family, and if the family's any good, then the family will put up with your shit and will accept you for who you are and love you and be proud of you. When you feel dislocated from your country, your original country and your original home, which obviously I do from time to time feel dislocated from it, to suddenly find that home in the middle of, you know, Gallifrey convention, or Long Island, or, you know, LA or Seattle or wherever the convention's stuff, to find that family of traveling fans, as it were, 3,000 traveling fans that go around for these fan dedicated. It was very touching. It was very, do you know what I mean? So for me, I think that was the surprising revelation, if that answers your question.
Yeah,
and then this is also something that's built, though, because we've been working on it so long, over 7 years, that it's like we've been seeing the same people as we've been making and as we've been finishing the project. You know, they've been following us. So it's sort of like the family was there and we didn't know about it in the beginning, but even just in the process of making this film, that family has gotten either tighter and also bigger.
Exactly. And our first graphic designer who did the festival poster that you see here, that's the obviously just, it's the basis of the poster that Caden Douglas designed this poster, and he came up with this tagline, you know, a family that's bigger on the inside. And I thought, yeah, this is brilliant. You know, he totally got it from watching the movie.
Fabulous. We've got a couple of rapid fire questions that have been submitted by our viewers and listeners. We're going to put them to you both, Matthew and Vanessa. Firstly, Matthew, Rassilon's Empire asks, do you ever see yourself working on another Doctor Who project?
I do.
Very good, very good.
Should the opportunity...
Rapid fire.
Should the opportunity arise, I'm ready and willing.
Super.
As they Fantastic. Say. And why not? They won't have me, I know, because they'll say, oh, he's old news. but you never know. You never know.
Well, fingers crossed. Yeah. We'd love to see it.
Absolutely.
Laurie Talbot, he says, Matthew, what would you have done if the series had been commissioned after the movie? Were there any stories that you sort of had in mind that you'd like to have told, or any monsters that you'd have liked to have used?
One of the things that I was excited about if it went into seasons was that the old format of the TARDIS breaking down somewhere or stopping somewhere, and then they have to get out, deal with the adventure, and then go back to the TARDIS. And the TARDIS just has one door. You know, there's no like, there's in fact, like door. The TARDIS that we designed for the TV movie had dimensions within it. And you can see that, hinted at, certainly when you go into the cloister room, the universe goes, but they can see it is truly a multi-dimensional place. So I was looking forward to having adventures that happened within the TARDIS, as it were, where dimensions could be explored in a slightly different, more philosophical way. That was the thing I was hoping for. And certainly there'd be new monsters. That would have been the thing. And certainly the heritage of the Doctor would have been just as flexible as I think it eventually became. The fact that, and we would have carried on with him as a romantic character, wouldn't have seen him, it wouldn't have become a sex show, but it would have become something where he could fall in love and she and people could fall in love with him. There is a tremendous romance in many ways between him and his fellow doctor, Dr. Grace Holloway. They're both doctors at the end. She's one of the first companions who says she doesn't want to come along with him. She says, no, I don't want to come. Why would I do that? You know, why don't you stay here? That's what she says. So we were quite ahead of the curve on those fronts. And those fronts are still now, you know, they're very much there in the show now. And I think I think that's a full answer to that question.
It was a good answer, Matthew. It was a good answer. Vanessa, Arlo McMillan asks, and we touched on this a little bit earlier, but how long did the documentary take to get made?
Oh, yes. Well, we started in February 2015, and hopefully Kaleidoscope has the finished film this week.
Fantastic.
So it took a very long time. a lot of effort on both of our parts. I did quit my job at one point to edit for several months, on and off throughout that whole time. And we're just a support network between Matt and me. We were both kind of holding each other's hands. I don't know if we were, but it was just like we were truly a team in finally getting it across the finish line.
Fabulous.
Fantastic. Matthew Gibson asks, Matthew, are you happy that you're more positively received by the American fan base now that enough time has passed from the 1996 TV movie? And what do you hope this documentary achieves?
I'm very happy with the way in which the TV movie is being received. The Radio Times announced this morning that it's TV movie month. Mm-hmm. They're going to do a whole series of pieces on Paul's Doctor, then I think, isn't that super? And obviously plugging the documentary, they're going to do that too. So, but I'm hoping that this documentary, obviously will lead to the next job. It's the same as everybody, it's the same as every filmmaker. You're saying, well, now, give us a job. You get another job, hopefully.
Hopefully.
Hopefully. I'm developing another TV show.
It's supposed to be a calling card, and this calling card wasn't supposed to last that long. But we'll see.
You never know. So, both of us are developing projects. And so you hope that those things will happen. And I do quite a bit of acting as well for Bernard Rose. And we've got a film called Traveling Light that actually premieres, I think, in a couple of days in Sheffield, so it gets its English premiere. And both Vanessa and I are in there playing funny characters.
Great.
Oh, that's great.
Love it. Vanessa, this is the final question for you both. Johnny Brown asked Vanessa, what were the most challenging aspects of making the documentary? I guess either from a technical perspective or in terms of actually getting you guys around. And in addition to that, whose idea was the TARDIS blue Mini Cooper? Because I thought that was a lovely little touch.
Oh, I'm so glad you thought it was the TARDIS.
You're the first person who's really got it.
Which it didn't come in there is that we're traveling around. The Mini should be like the TARDIS, and you don't know which of us is the Doctor, which one is the companion.
I like it.
But we were just like, it was like too complicated. We're like, we'll leave it to the person to make that connection. But yes,
well,
I still
done.
Have that Mini blue TARDIS, and it's been in a couple movies now, so it's still going.
Love it. In terms of the aspects of actually shooting it, the logistics and stuff, what was the hardest part for you, Vanessa?
I mean, the shooting, there was an element that we were co-directing. Neither of us had done that before. Production, you can pull it together. You know, we did that. For me, once you're done shooting, then you're stuck with all this footage, and then it's not going to become something until you edit it together. So I think the editing was one of the hardest things that I've done, but I've learned a lot. Matthew's a screenwriter, and so he knows story, and I learned so much from just editing this film. It's such a complicated question. I almost feel like the whole thing of just getting to the end was the hardest, because we put our hearts and souls into it, and all the people we brought in, Mark Leggett, David Burgess. Mark Leggett did the score. Dave Eichhorn did the sound design. Everyone gave so much of themselves just to finish it. So it's kind of the whole thing. It is a chapter. It is like a journey of Matt and me and our friendship. We're still friends and go out to dinner and catch up and whatever else. So I guess the whole thing, you watch the movie and it's just so much work, and it's both of us like pouring ourselves into it.
I think, yeah, isn't it? It really is. It feels like that. And you're talking about American Anorak is not like a big company. It's just two of us. And sometimes, people don't recognize that. They think you're a big company.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think, so the challenge is the hardest thing in some ways when you're making something independently, truly independently, then having the courage to keep going is in some ways the hardest thing, because there comes times when you think nobody's really going to show this. And we talked about that earlier. But I think when it does happen and people want to see it, then you've got to step up to the plate and commit. It's exciting. My son's getting married next week. He's stepping up to the plate.
Oh, yeah, it's this week, isn't it, Matthew?
Yeah, he's getting married on Sunday coming, yeah, in Mexico.
I love it.
Exciting.
Very exciting. And I have to write, because it's a sort of Colombian wedding, I have to, the father of the groom has to write something. I'm working away on a TV show, but I'm getting really distracted trying to come up with something to say that is a joke.
You'll get there.
I have a feeling you're going to come up with something really lovely.
Hopefully, fingers crossed.
Love it. Well, thank you both so much for your time.
Thank you.
Doctor Who Am I is out in select cinemas around the UK on the 27th of October. It's out on DVD, Blu-ray and digital download on the 28th of November. Guys, thanks so much for being with us. It's been a pleasure to speak to you.
It was wonderful speaking to both of you.
Thank you for having us, Billy. Oh, my voice went all weird. That sounded like... thank you for having us.
You're more than welcome.
It's been fantastic, really.
Thank you very much. That's brilliant. Well, that's it from us. Join us next time when... What are we talking about next time, Billy?
I'm sure you guys have probably guessed we'll be talking about something to do with Doctor Who, and we'll leave it a mystery until then.
Yeah. So, until then, see you next time. Bye-bye.